Now, when I was thinking about tonight's sermon earlier on in the week, it was my intention to have as one of our hymns that great paraphrase of Psalm 46, God is our refuge and our strength. But for some reason, when it actually came to choosing my hymns yesterday and phoning them through to Julie, it completely slipped my mind that I was going to do that. And so that's why we haven't sung that this evening. But the reason why I wanted to sing that hymn originally was that in that hymn, I think, you have the answer to the question, why study the life of Jacob? And it's in that recurring refrain that you have in that hymn. The God of Jacob is for us a refuge, strong and sure. Why study the life of Jacob? After all, here's this man, and he lived in a different age to us. He lived in a different culture to us. He lived in a different part of the world to us. He spoke a different language to us. What on earth do we have in common with this man, Jacob? But there you see, in that refrain, in that paraphrase of Psalm 46, you have the answer. The God of Jacob is for us a refuge, strong and sure. What do we have in common? We have the same God. We have the same God. Yes, all these other things might be different. We might not have anything else in common, but we have the same God. And it seems to me then that by studying the life of Jacob, we can gain some tremendous insights into this God who is our God as well as Jacob's God. And I don't really want to say much more than that by way of general introduction to this series. The biblical account of Jacob doesn't start with Jacob as a grown man, doesn't start with Jacob as an adolescent, it doesn't even start with Jacob as a child. It starts with Jacob still inside his mother's womb. And so you don't need me to give you all kinds of background details to Jacob. You don't need me to fill in any gaps like that. We can pretty much just dive straight into the text itself. And that's what I would like us to do now without any further ado. So let's look together then at Genesis 25, verses 19 to 34. And I'd like us to do so under four headings. First of all, tonight, a fallen world. A fallen world. Because it seems to me that one of the fascinating things about this passage is the way in which, woven into its very fabric, so to speak, there are some unmistakable echoes of Genesis chapter 3. Genesis chapter 3, of course, is the account of man's first rebellion, man's original rebellion against God, the account of that event which we often call the fall. And as I say, it seems to me that we are meant, we are intended to be reminded of that passage as we read this one. Let me just initially highlight two echoes that we have here of Genesis 3. One is the account at the end of the passage of Esau and his birthright, this well-known incident. And what we have here is essentially a man being tempted by some delicious-looking food, in this case, a red stew, being tempted by that to forfeit God's blessing, his birthright, his status as the firstborn of the family. And he yields to that temptation. Now, doesn't that remind you of Genesis chapter 3, where we have Adam and Eve being tempted by some delicious looking food, in their case some fruit, to forfeit God's blessing, in their case all the blessing that was contained within the Garden of Eden. And they too, of course, yield to that temptation. So there's an echo of Genesis chapter 3. But then we have another one, I think, in the account of Rebekah's pregnancy. We're told in verse 21 that Rebecca was barren. And it seems quite possible when you compare verse 20, Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebecca, with verse 26, Isaac was 60 years old when Rebecca gave birth, that this barrenness lasted for a full 20 years. But then we read in the second half of verse 21 that Rebecca became pregnant. What a joyful development. What a happy ending to these 20 years of infertility and barrenness. But then we read in verse 22, the babies jostled each other within her, and she said, "Why is this happening to me?" And that's a lame translation. It's more literally, "If it is like this, why am I here?" In other words, here is Rebecca, and she's waited for 20 years to become pregnant. And yet now that she finally has become pregnant, such is her pain and her agony and her discomfort in her pregnancy that she wonders why she's here. She almost despairs of being alive. Why am I continuing? Such is the agony that I am going through. Now, doesn't that remind you of Genesis chapter 3? "I will greatly increase your pains in childbearing." And so I'm saying then that there are these echoes, it seems to me, woven into this passage of Genesis chapter 3 and what happened there. And why then? Why these echoes? Well, we're quite familiar, aren't we, these days, with that phrase being used, that we are living in a post-9/11 world. What do people mean by that? Do they mean simply that chronologically we're living on this side of the event rather than on the other side? Well, of course, that's not what they mean. That's obvious. That's self-evident. No, what they mean is that we are living in a world which has been profoundly changed by what took place on September the 11th, 2001. We are living in a world that has been decisively shaped, if you like, by the events in New York City that day. And here you see, we are being told, I think, that the world of Genesis chapter 25, the world into which Jacob is about to be propelled, is a post-fall world. It's a world that has been decisively shaped by what took place that terrible day in the Garden of Eden. It's a world that you simply cannot make sense of without reference to what happened there. We're being told, in other words, that throughout all the time that has now elapsed since Adam ate the fruit that day, since everything went pear-shaped that day, things haven't just naturally straightened themselves out again. Things haven't just naturally reverted again over time to what they were before he ate the fruit. The events of Genesis 3 haven't just receded slowly into insignificance and into obscurity. No, here we are, several centuries down the line, and still the events of Genesis 3 are casting their shadow over everything. Still, this is very much a post-fall world. So that's the first heading, a fallen world. Second heading, an exciting hope. An exciting hope. Because you might be thinking, well, that's a very depressing starting point. But remember that back there in Genesis chapter 3, the fall isn't the only note that is struck. But if you'll know that passage, you'll remember that at one point, in verse 15 to be precise, very suddenly, very unexpectedly, amidst all the doom and gloom, this note of hope suddenly erupts. This exciting hope suddenly breaks through. And here now, in Genesis 25, we're being told by this writer that not only is the fall of Genesis chapter 3 still casting its shadow and still exercising its grip, but also that the hope of Genesis chapter 3 is still alive and well. What was that hope? What was the hope that suddenly burst through in Genesis 3:15. Well, there were two parts to it, weren't there? First of all, you remember, God announced to the serpent, "I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and hers." God is announcing there, in other words, that from now on, history is going to be dominated by a massive, massive conflict. A conflict between two completely different seeds, two completely different peoples, two completely different lines, if you like. From now on, history is going to be a huge war zone. So that in every single generation there's going to be this huge fault line separating the human race. And on one side, there will be those who are the seed of the woman. And on the other side, there will be those who are the seed of the serpent. And these two seeds will be constantly coming to blows with each other. And isn't that echoed here in Genesis chapter 25? Verse 22, we read then that when Rebecca is pregnant, the babies jostled each other within her. But again, it's a lame translation. It's more literally, the babies smashed each other within her. And she said, as we've already seen, if it's like this, why am I here? But then she goes and inquires of the Lord. And the Lord says to her, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you will be separated. Or more literally, two peoples from within you will be divided. And you read this and you think, well, this is all a bit odd, isn't it? We're just talking here about two babies in the womb. And yet there's this kind of violent, highly charged language of smashing each other and separation, division going on. What's going on here? Well, as the story of Jacob unfolds over the ensuing chapters, it becomes very apparent what's happening here. That this is precisely that conflict which was predicted back there in Genesis chapter 3. That this is that conflict between two different seeds, Jacob belonging to the seed of the woman, and Esau belonging to the seed of the serpent. So that was one part of the hope that was expressed in Genesis 3, this conflict. But of course, the other part was in the last part of Genesis 3:15. I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and hers. He will crush your head, and you will crush his heel. And God was there announcing, you see, that this conflict wasn't just going to rumble on and on and on endlessly and aimlessly without any resolution. No, God was saying that this conflict was eventually going to come to a great resolution. There was going to be a victory. And you notice how it's very individual. He will crush your head. And God was announcing then that one day there was going to be one specific person representing the seed of the woman, one specific seed of the woman, who would himself come face to face, head to head, with the serpent himself, and in a climactic and devastating conflict, would crush finally and irreversibly the serpent himself. Now, Jacob was not to be that one seed of the woman. Jacob was not to be that one individual who would finally crush the head of the serpent himself. But when we see in this passage this sight of Jacob asserting himself over Esau, that's what is referred to in verse 23, isn't it? Two peoples from within you will be divided. One people will be stronger than the other. And the older, that is Esau, will serve the younger, that is Jacob. And then, of course, we see that being illustrated in a very graphic fashion in the last part of the passage when Jacob robs Esau of his birthright. And as I say, then in this sight, in this spectacle of Jacob asserting supremacy, over Esau. Are we not seeing a little foreshadowing, at least, of what would happen many centuries later when a man called Jesus would so gloriously and so magnificently assert his supremacy over the serpent himself, there in the unlikely surroundings of a Roman execution site, in the unlikely situation of being nailed to a cross, there so devastatingly crushing the head, not merely of Esau, but of the serpent himself. And so then, Genesis 25, with its echoes of the fall, it may, as we've already said, be a stark reminder that things aren't simply going to just straighten themselves out naturally. The fall isn't going to just kind of naturally undo itself over time. Here we are several centuries later and it hasn't happened. The fall's still dominating this world in which Jacob is born. Yet at the same time, Genesis 25 is also a powerful reminder that God was determined that he was going to straighten things out. God was determined he was going to overturn what had happened in Genesis 3. It wasn't going to happen by some natural evolutionary process, by some just long kind of series of imperceptible little changes. That wasn't going to happen. But God was going to do it. And he was going to do it dramatically and spectacularly. God was going to overturn the tragedy of Genesis chapter 3. So we've seen then a fallen world, and we've seen secondly an exciting hope. But thirdly, a flawed character. A flawed character. We've been talking then about how Jacob was distinguished from Esau in this huge way. Jacob was the seed of the woman, Esau the seed of the serpent. We've been talking about how Jacob, in a small way, foreshadowed the great conqueror who would come many centuries later, Jesus Christ. Of course, later on in the Old Testament, in Malachi, and then in the New Testament, quoted by Paul, we read about how Jacob was loved while Esau was hated. And in the light of all that, you might get the impression, therefore, that Jacob was this heroic kind of character. Jacob was this great man, while Esau was this pathetic, evil man. And yet, doesn't the incident at the end of chapter 25 explode that? Because here at the end of chapter 25, we have this occasion when Esau then comes back from hunting and he's famished and he wants Jacob's stew. Jacob is there cooking. And you would have thought, wouldn't you, this great man Jacob then, that he would have just been generous and magnanimous. Yeah, of course you can have some stew, my brother. Of course I'll give you some food. You're hungry, you've been hunting. But no, he's so mean-spirited, isn't he? He says, first sell me your birthright. There's no brotherly love there. No sense of sympathy, understanding of Esau, who's come in tired and needy. There's a harshness there. There's a meanness there in this man, Jacob. And then it gets worse, because you can easily overlook it. But as the story continues, of course, Esau does sell his birthright to Jacob. He agrees to this transaction. And then we read in verse 34, and it's a kind of sting in the tail. Then Jacob gave Esau the red stew. No, it doesn't say that. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread, and literally some lentil soup, some lentil broth. He didn't even give his brother the red stew in the end. He gave him some lentil soup and some bread. He's cheating him. He's not been honest here. He's not shown himself to be a man of integrity. There's not only a meanness about this man Jacob, but also a dishonesty. And he doesn't then come across as this great hero that you might expect. He doesn't come across as this saint that you might expect, with a shining halo above his head. Indeed, I don't I'm not even sure that he comes out of this any better than Esau does. Esau certainly doesn't bathe himself in glory. He proves himself to be a bit of an idiot, selling his birthright like that. But Jacob, he's not much better. Here's the seed of the woman. Here's the one loved by God, we're told later on in the scripture. Here's the one who's foreshadowing Christ. Here's the one in the line that the Messiah will come from. And yet, he shows himself to be a mean man, lacking generosity, lacking human kindness. And this is only the start, as we will see in the coming weeks. He goes on to show many more of those kinds of characteristics. In other words, the story of Jacob isn't the story, at the end of the day, of a great man, a heroic man, a great saint, a super saint. The story of Jacob is the story of the triumph of God's grace. And it's the same, isn't it, with so many of the Bible's heroes. You read Hebrews 11, and there are some people who are mentioned there, and if they weren't mentioned there, you probably would write them off altogether. Who would have thought that Samson was a believer at all? And yet there he is in Hebrews chapter 11 as a man of faith. It's God's grace that we're seeing here. This man Jacob, he was a profoundly flawed character. He was a man with many undesirable, unpleasant traits in him. And yet, he was a man whom God had set his favor upon, and whom God loved, and whom God was going to use, and whom God had caught up in his great plan of redemption. And isn't that so encouraging for us tonight? We're a group here, we're a bunch of profoundly flawed characters, don't we know it? We're a bunch of Jacobs. There's so much in us that is mean and unkind. There's so many areas in our lives that are stubborn and recalcitrant and difficult. So many angles about us. And yet, God has come to us in grace. God has saved us. God bears with us. God is working on us. God is keeping us. God is preparing us. God is active in our lives. What a tribute, what a testimony to the grace of God. And that, as I say, is what we're going to see in this life of Jacob, and that's what I want you to hold before you all the time. That this is about the triumph of God's grace. It's not about a great man, certainly not. It's about the triumph of the grace of God. So we've seen then a fallen world. We've seen an exciting hope. We've seen a flawed character. And then fourthly and finally, an important warning. An important warning. It wouldn't be right, would it, to finish this chapter, to go home this evening without making some comment about Esau. We're not studying him, we're studying the life of Jacob. But what are we to make of this man? And particularly in this passage, what are we to make of his conduct here? What are we to make of him selling his birthright like this? Well, one answer to that we can be sure of because it's in the Bible itself. The Bible itself makes one application, at least, from this act of Esau's in selling his birthright. It's in the New Testament, in Hebrews chapter 12. And you all know, I'm sure, the context of this epistle to the Hebrews. This epistle was written to Christians who were struggling. They were struggling with the temptation to go back to Judaism, basically. They were finding following Christ a hard walk to walk. They were finding it hard to be disciples of Jesus. They were being persecuted. They were being subjected to all kinds of stresses and pressures. It wasn't easy. And they were being tempted in that situation by the easy option of going back to Judaism, to the ceremony and the rites and the pomp of what they had been used to. And remember how then it's in that context that the writer draws upon this character. Esau. And he says then in verse 16 of Hebrews chapter 12, "See that no one is sexually immoral or is godless like Esau, who for a single meal sold his inheritance rights as the oldest son. Afterwards, as you know, when he wanted to inherit this blessing, he was rejected. He could bring about no change of mind, though he sought the blessing with tears." And you see, here then, as I say, are these Hebrew believers. And they are being tempted in the face of difficulty, in the face of suffering. They are being tempted to opt for immediate relief by going back to the pomp and the ceremony of Judaism. And the writer is saying here, look, that's what Esau did. Esau was tempted when he was hungry, when he was famished, when he came in from hunting and he was exhausted. He was tempted by the prospect, by the option of immediate relief from that, to forfeit God's blessing. Don't you Hebrews do the same? Don't be tempted by the prospect of immediate relief to forfeit God's blessing. Persevere in the way of Christ, even though it's hard and there won't be any relief until the day that you arrive home. And that's an application then that we can take too from the life of Esau. Because we too are often tempted to go for immediate relief. And there's many ways in which we can do that. It's hard being a Christian. As we said this morning, it involves often being slated. It involves often being mocked. It involves often being marginalized and excluded. And often, the temptation is to go for immediate relief and just abandon Christ, or at least play it all down a bit. Compromise a bit. Have one foot in the world's camp as well. But the writer of the Hebrews is saying that's what Esau did. Esau went for immediate relief in that moment when he was hungry and famished. He sold his birthright and afterwards he regretted it. And if we opt for immediate relief and go back to this world and immerse ourselves in it, we too will regret it with all our hearts. And so let's make sure tonight that we are learning from the example of Esau and persevering and not opting for immediate relief. Well, that then is our first study in this life of Jacob. The world into which Jacob was born was a profoundly fallen world, a bleak world, a depressing world. And yet within that world, God was doing something. God had a redemptive project. God had a redemptive plan. And that is seen very clearly in the life of this man, Jacob. Jacob was a flawed character. He was no super saint. And yet he was the object of God's grace. And Jacob had a brother who is a salutary warning to us all of what happens when you opt for immediate relief and forfeit the blessing of God. May he help us to learn these lessons. Amen.